to Soweto, Sudafrica. We sing the song of solidarity with freedom fighting defenders of liberty who use the truth as a shield. There is no bullet that can kill the truth when you defend it with reason. So let's join together to end this evil madness that we all call racism, both here and there.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Street Heat Show. This is our monthly celebration of the struggle for workers' rights and social justice. I'm your host, Pam Whalen. Mike Rhodes is on the control. Today we're going to be talking about what folks are doing locally and on a statewide level to deal with officer-involved shootings and police accountability. We're going to talk about big changes at the Community Alliance newspaper, and we're also going to talk about what folks are doing to clean up the air and save the planet from burning up. So all real important stuff here today. And we're going to start off talking about the whole question of officer-involved shooting and police accountability. We're joined in the studio by Bryson White, who is a community organizer with Faith and Community. Welcome, Bryson.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, so there's a lot going on around this issue. Of course, this has probably been the biggest issue in the country for the last year, with all the horrible things that have been happening, and so much of it now on video, so that we get the visuals, and I kind of feel like it's always been happening, but now all of a sudden it's actually something that people are aware of, and there's a lot of visibility. So tell us what's going on with this issue. You know, what are the things that people need to be paying attention to, and what stuff that folks in Fresno are doing?
Yeah, so it's a pleasure to be here again, Pam. And so locally, some of the things that we've been doing, our organization, in partnership with a few others, just hosted a town hall on Tuesday with the Department of Justice. And it really was a space for us to begin to get outside, to try to the process, begin to get outside oversight on local police accountability. As you know, the recent article that kind of really detailed out the struggles of the Fresno Police Department when it comes to officer-involved shootings, and there's been, you know, many activists out here for years who have been highlighting this issue here locally. But we really wanted to bring forth the issue, really highlight the fact that the tale of two cities that we have in the city also makes itself manifest in the way policing our neighborhoods. And so it was really a space for us to really try to get some concrete commitments from the chief of police going forward. We don't believe that they are the end-all, be-all to get FPD on track, but we do believe that it's a step in the right direction. And so you want me to tell you what those recommendations
are? Sure, absolutely.
So a few of the things that we were able to get the chief to commit to, the first and most important one was for him to actually invite the COPS Department of the Community-Oriented Policing Services Department of the Department of Justice here to Fresno to do an assessment of Fresno's community policing model, which, you know, right now we know that we don't have a community policing model. And so in a few months, after there's been some internal work on it, there'll be a report out and assessment done to see where they are in that process. So we think that that's a small step in the right direction. And also he actually also agreed to, in his implicit bias training of Fresno Police Department officers, to actually outsource to another agency to be able to do that training for local police officers. Currently, there's a local police officer who's doing that training, you know, but with, you know, all of the recent, all the ongoing events involving Fresno Police Department in the community, we know that there's a large section of our community who rightfully has a distrust for the police department to do that internal training in the way in which it should probably be done. So he actually agreed to, for the sake of community trust and for the training of his officers, to outsource to another agency to do that. So again, we think it's a step in the right direction, but won't solve the entire issue, you know, because an implicit bias training isn't going to just undo centuries of racial animus that has been put into our society. And then the other piece was around data transparency as it relates to school resource officers who are on every campus, who have the ability to hand out citations. And we know the connection between citations, suspensions, and the school to prison pipeline. And currently there is no way to track that data as to how our school resource officers are citing our young people and for what purposes and reason. And so he agreed to create a statistical piece for that. And so these are all pieces that collectively point us into a direction, but there's still lots of work to be done going forward here locally, and so much work to be done locally and across the state and the mm-hmm. country.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, I was there on Tuesday, and there's hundreds of people there, and it was really good to see a lot of people in the community out around this issue and really organized in a way that, you know, kind of puts them on the hot seat a bit. Mm-hmm. That was really great to see. I want to talk a little bit about community policing because there's a couple things, and I'm you know, I do this in my day job, a lot of this, but I'm certainly not an expert on it. But, you know, a couple of the trends I've seen in policing in Fresno that I find very disturbing, I guess, could be under the rubric of community policing. You know, one thing that we have is, you know, sort of this homeless task force that basically seems to donate to allocate a very large amount of resources to just basically sort of harass homeless folks 24/7, and kind of like that's community policing, right? Mm. Because you're just, you know, you're dealing with the community, not in a very nice way. And the other thing that I find really disturbing is the idea of putting police officers on the school campuses,
right.
And you know, I know there's probably, it's complicated. There's probably a lot of things involved, but particularly when we're talking about, you know, the school-to-prison pipeline, it seems like this is like a way to kind of have us, you know, catch in the water really upstream here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you would like to respond to either one of those.
Yeah, I definitely agree with both of those. I definitely I'm not in agreement with officers being on high school campuses or even junior high campuses for that matter. I think it's just reflective of our city as a whole. Instead of being proactive in terms of investment into education, you know what I mean, into parent-teacher relationships at a young age, to our young people are able to be engaged from an educational standpoint, instead of us moving resources in that direction, you know, we've typically, you know, we then move resources to have an officer on campus, which kind of like really encapsulates as a city where we do our investment historically, which has been tough on crime versus, right, investment into solutions for people to be able to flourish. You know, we're a city that relies heavily on penalizing folks, and so I think that's deeply disturbing and problematic. And one of the testimonies from our young people was lifting up the tension for her, you know, and what that's like to have an officer on campus, because it is like a grooming, you know, and a monitoring and a pushing of
sort
our
of
young
normalizes
people.
The whole
it's the normalizing of being monitored, which, you know, ends up being in, you know, what the prison system is about,
right.
And so so that is disturbing,
right.
Okay,
why don't we switch gears a little bit and talk about there's some big stuff happening at the statewide level, and I guess I have somewhat a point of pride that California kind of is taking the lead on a lot of these very important issues, and I know you've been involved with the AB 953, mm-hmm. and that's going to kind of have a major, it's either going to happen or not soon.
Right.
So tell us about 953 and what's going on with that.
Yeah, before maybe I even say what about 953, I think maybe it's good to put into context as well. But 953 is a bill aimed to curb racial profiling in California through data collection to where an officer has to record the race, the gender, the sexual orientation of the person that they've stopped, whether or not property has been seized, and also reporting whether or not for the purposes that a person was pulled over. And currently there isn't, you know, a system in place to where police officers have to actually record all of these pieces. And so, I mean, that's really important, you know, in the context of American history, which is, you know, policing is such a highly racialized environment where, particularly as it relates to the black body, which has always been, particularly post-slavery, has always been something to be corralled into certain spaces, right? I mean, so during the slave period, folks are chattel and used to make money. You know, post slavery, you know, you have the rise of Jim Crow, which then, you know, law enforcement is used to push people into the penal system so people can begin to make money off of convict leasing. You know, departments across the country, such as Los Angeles in the 50s and 60s, are recruiting Southerners for the express purpose, you know what I'm saying, of bringing about police brutality on the black residents of Los Angeles, saw the same thing in Oakland and law enforcement agencies across the country. And so really AB 953 is, it's trending because of the recent, pieces that are in the media spotlight, but it's really a continuation of a long history of the police departments demonizing the black body, which also encompasses the entire spectrum of people of color. So 953 is something that just got out of out of suspension, right? So it's coming up to the Senate for a vote, and if it passes through the Senate, the governor, you know, it's up to him for him to sign it into law. And so California is really in a position once again to be able to lead the nation in an issue such as law enforcement, to where we, you know, really birthed the mass prison industrial complex of the 80s and 90s, but now we are in a position to lead in a proper way, right, versus leading it in a moral way, which we did before. So on Wednesday, you know, September the 2nd, Faith and Community, the ACLU, social justice organizations across the state, PICO California, we're going to Sacramento to do a massive action to say that the people of California, we want something new, right? We don't want to continue this cycle of state-sanctioned violence towards people of color. You know, we want to end this prison-industrial complex that has destroyed and ravaged communities across the state and nation. And so we'll be joined with about 2,000 folks from across the state. We'll be giving speeches. We'll be doing actions, die-ins, civil disobedience, to really bring a moral message to Sacramento, saying, you know, from a faith perspective, our organization is a faith-based perspective. So to say that, you know, every person is created in the image of God, regardless of race, sexual orientation, whatever category we've created, and we're all worthy of dignity and worthy of respect, and that our law enforcement officials, those who are called to serve, need to serve in that light, that we are all created in the image of God, and that none of us should be demonized and corralled and abused and crowded into spaces such as ungodly prison conditions. And so we're looking forward to Wednesday just being a real space of prophetic engagement to call to the power structure that, you know, we want a new day in California as it comes to police and community relationships.
Okay, you're listening to KFCF Fresno 88.1. We're talking to Bryson White from Faith and Community here in Fresno, and we're talking about officer-involved shootings and police accountability. Tell us exactly how people can plug into this, and also what other activities are available for people that are interested in this issue.
So you can plug in directly by on Wednesday at 6 a.m. We'll be departing from the Saints Rest Baptist Church, which is 1550 Reverend Chester Riggins Avenue in Southwest Fresno, departing for the Capitol. If you are interested, please contact me at Bryson, B-R-Y-S-O-N, at F-I-C. PICO.org, because there potentially is going to be, there's limited space, and so we want you to be able to register versus just, you know, maybe just showing up and not being able to to go due to limited resources. And so if you're interested, please contact me. So that's one direct on-ramp into this issue. And the issue for faith and community is something that we do is called Live Free, which is a national campaign within PICO, which seeks to end urban gun violence, criminal justice reform through the destruction of mass incarceration, and police accountability issues, police community relationships. And so we'll have some events going forward. We have a strategy team that meets once a month, and so if you're interested in that, you can contact me at the same email address, where we work on issues of gun violence in our community, pretrial reform, incarceration reform in general around this campaign, and police accountability. So those are some ways in which you can plug in to the work that we're doing. And there's other organizations in the city that are doing great work around police accountability issues as well that you can plug into also.
All right. And why don't you just state one more time exactly what's going on September 2nd and where or when people should be there? And
September 2nd, Saints Rest Baptist Church, departing at 6 a.m. to the Capitol to join with hundreds of people, actually thousands of people from across the state, to call on our public officials who are supposed to be of service to us to pass legislation called AB 953, which is a bill to curb, and I would hope to end, wishful thinking, racial profiling in California. And so we're joining with thousands of people to prophetically say to the power structure that we want a new way of policing in our cities, and we no longer want our young people and people of color subjected to state-sanctioned violence by our law enforcement officials who are supposed to be serving us. And so so that's Wednesday, September 2nd, 6 a.m. departing, Sacramento, AB 953, and it's going to be a powerful day of action.
And folks be at St. Rest Church.
St. Rest Church.
Yeah, at 6 a.m. And all right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Hopefully everybody who's interested gets a chance to help out with this. Thank you, Bryson White. And we're going to take a brief break, and we're going to come back and talk to Hannah Brandt, who is the newest and first female editor for the Community Alliance magazine. So that's going to be really exciting. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to KFCF Fresno, 88.1. You're listening to the Street Heat Show, our monthly celebration of the struggle for workers' rights and social justice. I'm your host, Pam Whalen, and joining us in the studio is Hannah Brandt, who is the new editor for the Community Alliance newspaper, which I think many people are familiar with. So welcome to the studio, Hannah.
Thank you so much.
So, Hannah, tell us about... This is a kind of a new big challenge in your life, right?
Yeah.
So tell us, you know, like, what has been your experience with the Community Alliance and, you know, what do you see happening with this new phase?
Great. Well, thanks again for having me. So I've been writing for Community Alliance for a year, basically right about exactly a year, which was when I came back to this area. I grew up here, but I had been living in the Bay Area. So, yeah, the experience has been really great, working with the paper, contributing on different subjects. I kind of got a bee in my bonnet to start doing journalism about a year ago. I was a teacher prior to that. I taught high school. So I just decided I always loved writing, and I decided to start reporting, primarily because I got to know a human rights activist from Cambodia. And I went and saw him speak, and when after I had heard him speak, I looked him up on social media, and I discovered that he had gone to Roosevelt High School like I did, and he hadn't mentioned that he'd ever even lived in the United States. So I was surprised to see that, and I contacted him, and he surprisingly, to me, very surprisingly, said that I could interview him. So I interviewed him via Skype. And that sort of got the ball rolling in terms of I kind of caught the bug to continue to report and write on issues that I thought were important. I've always been really committed to social justice issues and injustice in general. So that was the focus that I had as a teacher. I taught in, you know, large urban schools with low-income kids from communities of color primarily, and so I've always been really invested in that, somewhat based on my own experience that was kind of somewhat unusual, I suppose. But, yeah, mm-hmm. So that's sort of how.
So why don't you talk about the Community Alliance and why do you think it's important? What do you think the role is that it plays?
Yeah, so
in
I think
the community in Fresno.
Yeah, excuse me. I think it's a really important paper. It's the only alternative we have to the mainstream press, and the mainstream media doesn't reflect our community too often. It's not objective, and it also leaves out a lot of voices that are very important on so many issues that are vital to our society. So we have contributors that are underrepresented voices. I want to continue to have as many of those as we can, continue to build on those connections, continue to have those voices represented in the paper, and keep the building that network in the community.
Okay, and what, I mean, you're going to be starting off next month, so... I guess, what do you see kind of opportunities and challenges that you're going to have in the coming, you know, 6 months or a year?
Yeah, so, well, it'll certainly be challenging at the beginning, especially because just the logistics of learning how to do this work, since I'm coming in from, as I said, education. So, some of the things that are coming down the pipeline that people will want to know about is that we are updating our website. And we've been working on that for a while, and it will be rolling out soon. I don't have an exact date, but people should definitely be looking for that soon because our website has been outdated and needed to be updated. And I'm hoping to do some content on the website that won't fit in the paper because a physical paper has finite space the way that a website doesn't. So I'm hoping to be able to have video there of actions that are going on and of things that are going on in the community, whether it be arts-based stuff. And, like, extended interviews, people that have been interviewed. For example, some of the interviews that I've done I have recorded, and I'm sure other people have, too, that I'd like to get up. Longer pieces that don't fit in the paper, for example. So things like that. And just continuing the good work that the paper's been doing, maintaining that that alternative to the mainstream press primarily. Yeah.
So, and what kind of things can people do to help you?
Well, we love to have people contribute. So if you love to write, if you're working in the community on all these different issues that are so important that we've been talking about, certainly submit pieces, submit writing to us. Or if you do artwork, if you take photographs, we're heavily volunteer-based, so we can always use more contributors. You know, if you do cartoons, whatever, definitely do that. And we can always use volunteers to help with sort of the nuts and bolts stuff as well. So, absolutely. And we're based at the Center for Nonviolence, so that's where our hub is.
Okay. And how can people, like get connected?
Connected in terms of...
you know, if they want to get involved.
Well, they can go to the website, and the email for the editor, for me now, is there right on the website. So the website is just FresnoAlliance.com. And as I say, you know, contact us however you want to contribute. Absolutely. We're really open to having as many new contributors as are interested in continuing to have those same contributors that have been doing such good work.
Okay. And is there anything else you'd like to just tell us about? What do you see as the big issues? What are the big things that you really, of course, you know, history always just surprises us every time.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what I taught. So, yeah, you know, I'm always thinking of how everything is in context of the historical, like what Bryson was talking about earlier. So there's always so many big issues that are coming up. In terms of next month, for example, I know it's Disability Awareness Month, so hoping to get some work around that. And, of course, the issue that we were just talking about, mass incarceration, police brutality, general racism, institutional racism, is getting more attention now. But as you said, it's an ongoing issue that has been under the radar for white people, but of course not for people of color. So it's very important that people are aware of that. Coming from education, I think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done around segregation is a huge issue to me, and we have a terribly segregated city, actually. So Fresno is sort of ground zero in some ways for some of these issues, in ways that sometimes I think people don't realize, whether it's poverty. You know, this new report that came out about how isolated poverty is some of the worst is in Fresno, isolated by ethnicity a lot. So the west side is very isolated, the southern part of Fresno in particular, and I've lived in that area, so I can tell you that it's very true. Fresno is surprisingly, for being in California, it's surprisingly conservative as well to some degree. But we have a larger progressive community here than I think we sometimes give ourselves credit for. And it's more diverse than we give ourselves credit for, too. So it's just making sure that we reach all of those people who are really part of the community and may not know how to, you know how to contribute, know how to get involved. So I think that's really important.
I'm thinking right now, if we're sort of talking about the media.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the really interesting things that's going on right now, of course, is, and the media is totally devoting immense amount of attention, is to the Trump presidential campaign. And then, you know, there was a very interesting incident last week where the director, and I guess his Jorge Ramos, I think.
Right.
Who basically, you know, really got, mm-hmm. you know, was in a press conference and was very direct in asking questions, of course, was then, you know, thrown out. And, you know, kind of there's a lot of stuff going back and forth on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. But just kind of, it's a kind of interesting... I mean, certainly Una Vision is, I consider, part of the mainstream press.
Sure.
But, of course, with its, you know, audience base, you know, has certain very particular interests. I just wonder if you could comment on that, why the press is paying so much attention to Trump, you know, and then the role of Una Vision in this debate.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I'm the best person necessarily to speak to that. I mean, I definitely heard about that incident. But in terms of why Trump is getting so much attention, I think that the that he's just crazy enough to some degree to get, you know, it's theater, and people will tune into that even if they think he's crazy too. So even places that are traditionally going to appeal to Democrats like CNN or MSNBC, people will still want to see the crazy Trump show kind of thing. But I think, unfortunately, he does really appeal to a base of Americans that really feel this way, too, which is really scary in terms of racist comments also against women. So some of the things that he's said about rape are really disturbing, too. It's a very disturbing trend. And I don't know that he's definitely said some of the craziest things, but some of the other GOP candidates have said some pretty wild things, too. So it's unfortunately become sort of normalized in that part of the party and to some degree across society, which is disturbing.
Mm-hmm. And then the role of Univision.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm really the best person to answer that question, but if you're talking about previously too with their connection with Trump, decision not to air the pageant,
the beauty pageant.
Yeah, the beauty pageant, that was a wise decision, but in terms of this most recent event, I'm not the best person to comment on that, unfortunately.
Okay, and we're talking to Hannah Brandt. She is new editor for the Community Alliance newspaper, and you're listening to KFCF Fresno 88.1. I don't know, what else would you like to make sure that our listeners know? I mean, of course, KFCF is another one of the very important media institutions
in
Fresno that does provide us an alternative voice.
Absolutely.
But what would you, maybe probably shares a lot of the same values as the Community Alliance, what would you like to make sure that the KFCF listeners know about the Community Alliance?
Sure. So the other thing I guess I would say is about the social media, which I've been sort of taking the lead on before even being the editor. I set up the Twitter account, which is at Fresno Alliance, and the Facebook page is also Community Alliance newspaper. So if you're interested in commenting on any of our work or seeing some of the things that we've put out, I'm thinking about also instituting some weekly chats on social media for the paper to get some engagement from the community and help with organizing with these various actions with other organizations in town. So those are important as well. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Hannah Brandt, the newest editor and the first woman editor of the Community Alliance newspaper.
Here we roar.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a brief musical break, and we're going to come back and talk about what's going on around climate change and the air quality and what you all can do about it.
Big dumb blonde with a wheel off gorge, and Turtle, that friend of hers with his checks all forged, his cheeks in a chunk with his cheese in the cash. They're all gonna be there at that $1 million bash. Ooh, baby. Everybody from right now is over there and back. The louder they come, the bigger they crack. Come now, sweet cream, don't forget the flash. We're all gonna meet at that $1 million bash. Talked to my counselor out in the barn. Silly Nelly was there, she told him a yarn. Then along came Jones, emptied the trash. Everybody went down to that $1 million bash. Ooh,
You're listening to KFCF Fresno, 88.1. This is the Street Heat Show, our monthly celebration for the struggle for workers' rights and social justice. And joining me in the studio is Kevin Hall, activist extraordinaire of Fresno and also representing the Sierra Club of California. And Kevin, you've been involved in issues of air quality and many, many issues, but certainly done a lot of work around air quality and of course, you know, we're all concerned about the climate change issues. So tell us what's going on around these issues right now.
Lots of pollution, Pam.
Lots of pollution. My lungs tell me that.
Yeah. I was driving my mom out to the airport at dawn. And you could see that backlit cloud bank of smoke over the Sierra Nevada. It wasn't like those cumulus clouds. It was just a flat bank of orange and black clouds. It's such a horrible situation. And our fire, which the rough fire is maybe 40, 50,000 acres now. State of Washington has 250,000 acres on fire. And I think everybody who listens to this station regularly or even occasionally or simply watches... Everybody's aware of climate change. I think everybody's familiar with the indicators of climate change. I think everyone knows the speed with which these impacts are occurring and the extremes to which they are growing. Between the drought, the fires, and the just the ground-level air pollution, which shares many of the same sources in common, it's the same story. I've been at this since about 1999, and we're right at the cusp of one of those. We're not at the cusp, but we're in one of those very critical decision-making points where in the next few weeks or less, we're going to make a big step forward or we are not, and it's coming down to moderate Democrats in the state assembly.
Okay, so what's – tell us exactly, specifically, what are the issues that we're looking at?
We're looking at two pieces of legislation. One is Senate Bill 32, which is an extension of our current goals at reducing overall climate change, overall greenhouse gas emissions from the state as a whole. This piece of legislation from Senator Fran Pavley would call for an 80% reduction below 1990 levels by the year 2050. It's a significant piece of legislation. It's essentially a cap-and-trade program. Frankly, many of us in the environmental justice movement are opposed to cap-and-trade. We believe a straight carbon tax is the way to go, but cap-and-trade is what we have, and it's generating, for the time being, and it's generating billions of dollars now that are supposed to flow into our communities toward clean air projects, which segues nicely into SB 350. So SB 32 is sort of the long-term framework, whereas SB 350 sets some more immediate goals.
Yeah, let's go back to AB 32 for a moment. We did have an editorial in the Fresno Bee this morning talking about kind of specifically their perceived flaws in the legislation, talking about the resources being directed towards the Central Valley, where, of course, we have very high poverty rates. And as you've just described, we're tremendously impacted by the climate change and by the pollution. I don't know if you want to comment on that and in terms of what's in the bills and what will they really do in that regard.
Well, maybe I could describe the second bill and then respond to that, because the elements of the editorial in the B, I think both bills, to your question, are addressed. The position of the expressed in today's editorial really doesn't strike me so much as an original position, but as a set of points that the B got from the industries affected and happened to agree with. They're not all here. Industry wants a lot more than this, but these are the ones that seem to satisfy the B's agenda or priority list. I'm not sure what to call it. However, the second bill, Senate Bill 350, is authored by Senate Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon, and it's literally three 50s. And we're going to 50% reduction in transportation fuel use in the state of California by 2030. So now this is a shorter-term bill, about 15 bills out. A growth in our commercial renewable energy production from about almost 33% right now to 50%. And the third piece is that we will improve energy efficiency statewide by 50%, which is, of course, meaning less energy being used. And that's always the best way to get to a higher use of renewable energy, or if people are trying to do something about climate change at home, just use less energy, you know, however you can. We start with a clothes dryer, and that's it. That's an actually very big step. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have these two big bills, and now industry is trotting out the same arguments against them that they have used forever. Okay. You know, the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, which were really targeting criteria air pollutants, means the stuff that causes smog and soot pollution on the ground level that we breathe. There's just the constant refrain has always been, you're going to kill jobs, you're going to drive up prices for everything under the sun.
Right.
Nice reference to the sun for renewables. Uh-huh. And none of it ever comes true. Do you know what happens is we create a lot of jobs. We create new jobs. And that's what's anticipated with 350. You raise the really important issue of equity, which the B does get right in some ways. Do you know, they're arguing correctly that the most impacted communities or regions should get that. And at the same time, they're saying, but that means it comes to the Valley and not Los Angeles. I'd be very careful with that argument, because if you really want to find millions of people of color and low income suffering tremendous impacts from diesel pollution, go look at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach and the stunning amounts of diesel truck traffic and trains that go right through these communities nonstop day and night. And then they go out to the Inland Empire next to these amazingly huge warehouse distribution centers. Or go to Richmond and look at the refineries, mm-hmm. and watch the fires. And again, who's living next to those facilities? So environmental justice communities are throughout the state. Go downtown or the west side, like in Fresno, of any city in this state, and you will find industry next to residents who are typically low income and people of color. And it is a statewide issue. Fortunately, in 2012... the legislature passed, that the governor signed SB 535 or 535. And what it does is it requires that 25% of all of these cap and trade funds be spent in these communities that most impacted. And don't let me forget, thank you, to point out that our disadvantaged unincorporated communities that are outside of cities like Fresno and are in the rural settings that are established originally as farm worker camps, and primarily still are farm worker mm-hmm. communities, these communities lack the sort of what they call active transportation spending, which creates safe places to actually walk and bike in your own community, safe streets and sidewalks, not to mention transit connections to other parts of the valley or work. So it's really important that we do pay close attention to this. I can't bring the bill number to mind. Jump in any time if I'm just going on too long.
No, yeah. I know that they did mention in the bill that actually that Henry T. Perea has about bringing
trucks.
some resources into the valley.
Yeah. He actually, the good bill he had was not really mentioned here. He had a good bill that was for technical assistance, so that these small towns and communities that don't have the staff that can actually apply for the grants and that uh-huh. sort of thing, or have this would help fund those positions to bring that money down. That is being sacrificed, I think, by Perea in his miscalculation here, that it doesn't pay to be a moderate Democrat. Okay, mm-hmm. We need progressive Democrats in
right.
Sacramento, and we deserve them. And we deserve another Dean Flores, quite frankly. He was the only person that really ever jumped over these hurdles that industry puts in front of them. So SB 535 is designed to bring that money to these communities. Back onto SB 350, that the fact that it's talking about, for example, that 50% renewable energy goal which can easily be met, by the way. What's going on there is we are already at 30%. We're supposed to be at 33 by 2020. Some utilities are already there, and this is the commercially generated electricity. Mm-hmm. It does not include rooftops, residential solar. But what the utilities are up to now is they are saying, we want to now count, despite their years of fighting, rooftop solar, and then the many hurdles that still exist, mm-hmm. now they want to count that toward mm-hmm. the renewable portfolio. Well, if we were to include that today, right now, we'd be at 45% renewable electricity in the state of California, meaning that they wouldn't have to build That's another amazing. Major commercial renewable energy project between now and 2030, because we'll pick it up, you know, through rooftops and residentials.
Right. Let's talk about PG&E for a minute. Yeah. So they're kind of they don't have a good track record on a lot of safety issues.
Okay.
They have been. I know a couple of years back they put something on the ballot to prevent local municipalities from having their own municipal districts.
Yep.
There's a list of a lot of things that I don't really like about PG&E. And, you know, they seem to be, how would I say it, not helpful in this conversion over to renewable energies. And I did have the chance to read Naomi Klein's new book, This Changes,
This Changes Everything.
Right? Yeah, which I put a plug in it for anybody to read it.
Thank you.
Really a great book. And although I love her, I don't always love all of her books, but this one I really do. And, you know, she was talking about how situations like in Germany, you know, where people in the in a community, in a town, would get together and say, you know, we really want to have solar panels. You know, we want to have rooftop renewable energy, and you know, went to the local, which would be equivalent to our PG&E, though maybe not quite as big, and said, you know, we want you to work with us. You know, we want to move over into the renewables and you know, really get to where we need to go. And that the company, which was like PG&E, a commercial company, just dug their heels and just absolutely, totally tried to do everything they could to block it. And the people in that particular area said, okay, fine, we're going to go put a measure on the ballot to bring this back into the public sector so we have control over it, and we can, you know, then dictate that we're going to move towards renewables. And, I mean, I haven't even heard of a conversation like that, you know, certainly in California, but just kind of your thoughts on where PG&E is at, and, you know, are they starting to get the memo or not?
Not, but I would like to point out that Governor Gray Davis did sign the Community Choice Aggregation Act over a decade ago, and we can do just what you described mm-hmm. anytime we put together enough votes.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be done by the law says that you could be a city or a county or an aggregation of cities and counties.
Hmm.
And so there are some municipalities that have enacted their, and the point of community choice aggregation is to create, it was designed specifically for renewable energy choice. What it does is it brings everybody, after the vote, it brings everybody into that city, for example, into the position of now buying power from their municipal utility district, we'll call
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the customer base you need so that you can finance the construction mm-hmm. of the renewable energy project.
Mm-hmm.
So, but to your point, PG&E has done a really effective job at beating these things back everywhere they can. And to your point, again, they tried to make it to roll back that law,
mm-hmm.
but they failed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were fired afterwards, I remember, within the utility. So mm-hmm. anyway, we do need a lot of that sort of thing. And I do think that the beauty of 350 and the renewable portfolio standard, which is means that every utility has to have 50% RPS, they call it, renewable energies within their portfolio of electricity that they generate commercially. We could really start to do that in communities around the state. Here's this funding now through cap and trade that mm-hmm. is going to be, again, generating billions and billions of dollars every year. Assemblymember Perea fought this and lost, but a big part of this now is that transportation fuels are also coming under this cap-and-trade system. So it generates a lot of revenue that, again, gets back onto these good kinds of projects. So that's why De Leon's bill is so important right
okay.
now.
Okay, so let's talk for a second about what would it look like investing this money into, like, say, Fresno? What would that look like?
Well, great question. I think that what it would look like would be specifically renewable energy projects. I think in low-income communities, what the law calls for, what SB 535, which calls for the 25%, says that 25% of the project, 10% of the hiring and training must happen of the money awarded with residents in the community. I think that we could get to really working alternative energy projects where you could have people who are trained and employed to build and install not just the commercial facility but the residential ones as well. On transportation, the goal there is oh, excuse me, let me do energy efficiency. The local, it's not Workforce Investment Board, but I'm sorry, the name of the agency that does
EOC?
EOC. Yeah. We have over $30 million right now coming into Fresno for training of people to do these kinds of jobs. And another $20-something million dollars on top of that going to a company that is working and training people to do residential solar installations. So we actually have I'm trying to keep my, not swear, I'm be enthusiastic about it. A lot of money coming into the community now to employ people and train and employ. And these are long-term careers. These aren't one-off kind of projects. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like some of the earlier programs, well, we're going to go out and maintain a park and we're going to learn to be, mm-hmm. you know, gardeners, which is a good, hard-working job. But these jobs are a step up from that. And they're skilled jobs, but without being overly difficult to master, and just tons of employment. Because imagine now as we're dictating that we're going to get to, they love that word dictating, that we're setting the goal of getting to 80% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. Imagine all the solar that will be installed and all the people that we employed doing that.
And it will have, you know, I mean, I have solar panels on my house.
Yep.
And
it was no easy feat.
Right. And it was quite expensive at that time.
Yep.
And we had some fortunate, you know,
yep.
that we were fortunately able to do that. And it's, I understand, much cheaper now. But, you know, it's just wonderful every time you get your PG&E bill and, you know, we got a little bit on the gas, but on the electricity, you know, it's just, I mean, and it just seems like, you know, given the poverty that we have here,
yep.
that just for people to be, you know, take that weight off of their backs, you know,
yeah.
in terms of putting food on the table and all that kind of stuff. It
yeah.
Very helpful.
The challenge with all these projects, and we met with Assemblymember Perea, and he had a really good concern that mm-hmm. needed to be addressed, which is that if you own the home, to qualify for the funding to do weatherization so that you use less energy, it has to be up to code. Mm-hmm. And not all homes are up to code, so you can't use that incentive funding to bring your home up to code, because mm-hmm. that money is meant for greenhouse gas reductions,
mm.
right? And so that's a really good point where we should be pushing and arguing. Unfortunately, the sort of objections we're seeing are all about, I'll give you my favorite about, I know we're getting to the end of the show here, but what industry wants right now is they're saying, look, on the petroleum reduction, any plan that the Air Resources Board comes up with should come back through the state legislature for debate and approval. What a nightmare that would be. That's a macro version of what we experience now at our Valley Air District, where it's a highly politicized regulatory scheme with the result that the industries that we're supposed to be regulating are actually controlling the whole process because they control the politicians
right.
making the decisions.
Right, right, right. It's the Koch brothers at the local level.
And this proposal would take it to the state level. And that's actually supported by the B in this editorial today, that they're not, I think, they're not thinking it through. How does that actually look? There's millions of dollars in advertising going out and doing a lot of fear-mongering. I don't know how much we're seeing of it in Fresno because, frankly, I don't watch
right,
podcast TV.
Right. I don't
but
either.
I hear in the major population centers, It's amazing amounts of money. About $11 million right. worth. But what they're basically telling people is some really ridiculous things about the kind of dictatorial mandates that will come down, and gas rationing and crazy stuff. And they're having impact on those urban legislators from these rural communities.
Okay. This you're listening to KFCF Fresno, 88.1. We're talking with Kevin Hall from the Sierra Club, California, and we're talking about legislation. And I do think we are close to the point, Kevin, we're going to have to get to punchline here. Tell us about the legislation and where it's at what do we need to do to get it over the hump?
That's a good question. So the legislation's in the state assembly. It's made it through the state senate. It's being held up by the moderate Democrats. Your local moderate Democrat is Henry T. Perea. He needs to be phoned. People need to call, especially people in his district, but anybody who can hear this broadcast is affected by this. And his office number in Fresno is, of course, area code 559 and 445-5532. So 445-5532. And you need to say, I support SB 32 and I support SB 350. Also, there are yard signs if you want to have a yard sign to show your support. And I would suggest messaging the Central Valley Air Quality Coalition through Facebook. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the most effective way of reaching folks. But I think the most important thing people can do is phone Mr. Perea.
Okay. And the vote's going to be soon?
In the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. 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 So can people, is it always talking about Facebook, Twitter, or is there any other ways that people can contact Henry Perea besides just phoning?
That's a great, I suppose you could go onto his website, mm-hmm. His state assembly website, just Google him by name, mm-hmm. And you will get an email link.
Okay, great. Well, 30 seconds, what do you want to...
I want to say that this is, again, a critical juncture, mm-hmm. and that we really have the opportunity here to set a wonderful direction for the next 15 and 35 years. Mm-hmm. And these moments don't come along very often. And these moderate Democrats, many of our young men, primarily Latino, many of them with children, they really need to be called and said, what are you thinking? Don't be intimidated by the oil industry. Stand up for us.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin Hall from the Sierra Club of California. And you've been listening to the Street Heat Show. We're here every month, the fourth Friday of the month. I'm Pam Whalen. Mike Rhodes is on the controls. And now we're going to take you back to the KPFA Evening News. Thank you.
The clouds whirl all across the land, feeling the wind blowing softly all those summer nights, hearing the sounds that the rain makes when it falls. I have been here forever, counting all the stars, watching the way the rivers flow like shadows.